Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. Tuesday Evenings is a weekly lecture series, with next week being the conclusion to what I think has been a wonderful spring lineup. Closing the spring 2009 series will be artist Rosin Crowe. As the subject of the next focus exhibition, she is here for Tuesday evenings in conversation with the curator of the focus shows, Andrea Carnes, to discuss Rosin's extravagant, large-scale works that reflect current tendencies in abstract painting, as well as Rosin's budding career as an exciting and young artist. I really advise you to try to make it, if at all possible. Tonight, we have with us the artist Donald Sultan. He is here to present his work and to announce the recent publication of the monograph, Donald Sultan, The Theater of the Object. I hope you were able to take advantage of the book signing in the lobby before the lecture tonight and perhaps made time to go upstairs to the second floor galleries and visit Dead Plant, November 1988, one of Donald's large, dark paintings that incorporate his signature use of tar from that period. Donald has a history with this museum. We own five works, including Dead Plant, as I mentioned, that we acquired the year after it was made, in 1989. Another signature piece and a personal favorite of mine, Black Lemons, May 20th, 1985, which is a charcoal drawing, and Morning Glories, November 1991, that I was going to say, be sure and turn off your phones. November 1991, that is one of the museum's centennial prints that, as I understand, are available for purchase if anybody's interested, and is currently in very good company on view in the Cafe Modern. In addition to works in the collection, Donald was one of the young artists in 10 plus 10 Contemporary Soviet and American Painters, which was curated by Dr. Marla Price in 1989. And his 1987 solo exhibition came to the Modern after traveling to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago and the MoCA in L.A. So many of you I know are here tonight to catch up and to hear from a familiar voice. Born in Asheville, North Carolina, Donald received his BFA from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he went on to get his MFA from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. He moved to New York in 1975, and since his first one-man show in 1977, Donald has enjoyed a distinguished career as a painter, a printmaker, and a sculptor. Donald's exhibition record is significant, with a number of one-person shows as well as group shows, including the 1979 Whitney Biennial. His work is included in the permanent collection of many prestigious institutions, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Dallas Museum of Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, as mentioned, the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. In 2008, the monograph, Donald Sultan, The Theater of the Object, the subject of tonight's book signing, was published to offer a survey of Donald's 30-year career and is likely, the basis of tonight's presentation. So I know we're all anxious to get started. So will you please join me in welcoming Donald Sultan?
Thanks. Normally when I do a talk, I kind of start with the first linoleum pieces and work all the way through the dark pictures and some of the early still lives and the tile floor pieces and things like that. And I realized that after a number of years of doing that, the talk was getting longer and longer and longer. So I decided today to start sort of somewhere new and bring up to date to the newest work. I started to show really basically they're going to be the themes that developed out of the flowers and the Morning Glory paintings. These paintings I got from when I was living in France. I was painting some small pictures. I did a lot of garden paintings. I did paintings of flowers and pots. And one of the things that I decided to do early in my career was to put back into abstract art the great themes of art, the landscape, the florals, and the still lives. And the reason I wanted to do that was in a modern way. I wanted to reintroduce themes of art, and that I could continuously see how, as they progressed, the direction I was going and whether or not I was actually improving. Because when I was doing mostly abstract pictures, I realized I could keep doing those for the rest of my life, but I would never know if I was actually doing anything any better than the last one. So I decided to make them more complicated, and so in addition to making a wide range of imagery, I've made my life a lot more complicated than I probably needed to do. I'm constantly using new imagery, and initially I had started by putting all these images together to make a room full of images that really were very disparate, like a flower painting, a disaster painting, and a flower painting. And the idea being that really art is what you see around you, and you see all of those things simultaneously in all imagery. It's the same as seeing a picture of a refugee camp in Afghanistan next to a lingerie ad for Bonwit Teller, and they occupy the same space. And we take all these in as different ways of looking. And so I did that for a long time, and I still sort of do that. I work on a number of pictures at the same time. But what I thought I would do in a way was sort of go through these and sort of show how one thing develops out of another, how by switching a few colors or a few objects, you can make quite a different statement each time. So this is one of the morning glories. I decided to shoot everything dead on at the time and use the background of the leaves kind of like cross-hatching in traditional drawing. I picked the morning glory really because I dropped some of this blue paint on something and I realized it was the color of the morning glory, so it gave me the idea to pursue it. And all of these are the same make. They're all floor linoleum mounted on wood, mounted on stretchers that are slightly raised from the wall, so the architectures of the building participate in the painting. And basically you have the floor ripped up and put on the wall. And a lot of that probably came from my theatrical background. I wanted to really command all of the theater that I was involved with in the art, the way of dealing with art. Being as an artist, you do everything, whereas in a theater you have so many different people involved, it's very hard to have a singular voice. And so I think of them almost as platforms. I think of them as frescoes. I don't think of them as narrative, however. I think of them really as telling a uniquely visual story. So I did a lot of these pictures where you're looking right down at the centers of the pieces. Part of the way I decided to work was to do emblematic images. I wanted to do images that after you saw them, I basically owned the image. So whenever you saw a morning glory like that, you would think of me rather than the other way around. And the introduction of the black image next to the color painted image is always to remind myself and the viewer that you're looking at a volume and you're looking at a flat piece and you're also looking at a design at the same time as you look at the original or the real kind of rendered piece. A lot of the paintings I do include a lot of art historical references as well. So you can see Redon in some, you'll see Manet in others, you'll see Matisse in some, you'll see different artists at different times, some still, some Pollock. This one was like the wall. I had a wall of these growing up, and there were very small. The French call it, just the word is volubilis, which is really just a morning glory. But for some reason, they seem smaller than the American variety, which I planted in my house in Sag Harbor, and I thought they were too big. And boy, once you get those going, it's hard to get rid of them. So this one, I finished after that one. I made it more regular. And I always thought of this one as what Captain Kirk saw when he looked out the big window on the Starship Enterprise. And this one, once I started reducing it, it led into another idea. Part of also using these images is that I like to use images that that remind me of the systemic aspect of our lives, that flowers, unless you're a botanist, really all the morning glories are going to be the same. And fruits or apples on a tree, the shape of these things are consistent. They're over and over again repeated. The wings of butterfly patterns, piles of oranges, piles of lemons, piles of automobile tires, food, steers, things that are used for manufacturing and are in herds and are put together, whether they're natural or not natural. I like to keep repetition because the materials themselves, also the floor tiles are repetitive. The panels are 4 feet. Everything's a standard issue. So I thought I'll start branching out with the dots into other images that we use every day, and I see it settled first on buttons, which I could take the plaster I was using to paint the flat images on, and I could sand it down and make a ridge. I could literally make a button and use very flat paint. And I went totally, I thought if I would make it as abstract as I could, which made it almost more realistic than the renderings of the morning glories. And one of the things I liked about buttons was that it's an image that's industrial, manufactured, and it's an image that's made to conceal something. It's an image that you use to close things with. It's not an image that's open-ended in that way. And I ran into a lot of people who grew up in the South whose mother would always sew extra buttons into their clothes in case they lost one. They'd always have another button. So it took on another aspect, and it also freed me up to make different colors. Again, very artificial colors as well, and flat. So also, I went to a simple black one. And this one, when I made it, I decided to give it a wax and a patina. And it ended up almost having the texture of a piano. And I liked it so much, and it's so hard. It's a very big, 8 foot round, black, ebonized paint with white dots in the center. And when people saw it, I had it in an exhibition, and all these young people would come. One guy came to me and said, there's a painting you can really knock your head against. And it feels a little bit like that. But again, it's an image that's repetitive, that you remember, you see, you deal with every day. And also, it was a way to contrast the black of the tar. The backgrounds of all of these that I've been using for 30 years are basically the materials people use for roads. So in addition to flooring, you have road work. And I use images that are very American, the road, the highways, and the linoleum tiles, which I consider to be our landscape, wood, and the materials we use for building. Somebody asked me if they thought that these materials would last, and I said, well, they'll last as long as the building you're standing in. And this, because of those black and white dominoes and buttons, I thought, well, I'll even go more into using systemic images that fit with the panels and the tiles. I'll use dominoes. And dominoes were almost perfect because, again, it was black and white. It was two squares put together to make an object. It was a simple object. And even though I never learned how to play dominoes, I enjoyed the way they looked together. I discovered that, you know, when you start making paintings like this, everybody in the world starts giving you advice. And people started sending me dominoes, and they taught me that white and with black pips are European dominoes, and black with white pips are Asian dominoes. So I thought, well, here's East meets West. And then I started putting them together randomly, keeping them abstract, but keeping a constant of squares and playing with them, really. And it's really funny how they take on the life of their own, like constellations, or they're very pattern-oriented, and but still, again, very much what they are. The edges of all these are rough because that's when we spread the materials, it falls over the edges, and it makes that's the natural way the material hardens on the edge of the painting. So it's not something that I do and can really control. I just keep it. Sometimes on the first dominoes, I cut the edges square so they would really be hard squares, but I didn't like it as much. Then when I was in Tulum, I saw them building some huts, and they've spread the cement floors over the edge, and it looked just like the edge of the paintings. They just let it blob over the side. This is all the East meets West. There's 28 dominoes of each type. And like some of the early drawings I did, I started using the edges of the paintings to contain them, so they'll lean against the edges and lean against each other and balance the random ones. And I like that so much, I thought, well, I'll go with the road imagery and the automotive imagery, and then I thought I'd take an image that you hang on your car, and I'll hang it on the painting. It's actually drawn on there, but I used a point so it looked like it was really just hanging on the top. And I thought, how do I make fuzzy dice? And I tried, I thought of a lot of different ways of doing it, of cutting out the fuzz and so on. And I thought, I'll settle for flocking. So in addition to that, the flocking gave us the fuzzy dice, but it also reminded me of the way you buy the little dog with the bobble-headed dog in the back of the car. They're all flocked, and it's a very durable industrial material. So I made a series of these. And I liked the dice image. This one I took from a street dice in New Orleans that are large Bakelite dice. And I just placed those like a still life. And then I decided to make boy-girl ones, boys and girls. And a little earlier, about the same time, I was making the flowers and the flower pots. And they came out of the smokestacks. And in the smokestacks and the flowers that I had done in the pots, which you'll see also in this next, I'll bring some of those up, the bottoms of them were meant to be kind of manufactured, and the top was meant to be gestural. So the fire coming out of the smokestack was sort of an uncontrolled, random image, and the smokestack itself was the rigid architectural element. So the vases in the first flowers were also always in the lower half, and the flowers would just spew out of them, drawn very loosely and painted, so that they became a kind of combination between gestural painting and geometric painting. And then I eliminated the flowers altogether, and I started using the imagery of the vase, stacking it on top of each other like the dominoes, and using that imagery over and over again. So I began to place those stuck in the center, and I did one that even that had three, so it was a reference to Brancusi's endless column, so you could just keep going up with it. There was no limit to how tall these could be. And also the Newman zip down the center of the painting, and also using the flowers that they painted on the vases as the flower reference to the work I was doing. And I decided I would use the corners and the edges of the paintings like you were packing them to sell, so you'd figure out how to use your painting as a crate. And then this is one of the flower paintings that I took out of the garden in Saint-Tropez. It's an acanthus. And I put it in the center like the vases and just let the edges go. And I started sticking those drawings right in the vases. And this one I drew with a chalk, and I started to cut it out, and I liked it sort of half cut out. And I thought, what should I do for the vase now? Because I didn't have I'd been using the Chinese vases. I thought I would take a drawing of mine, and I would have it made into a silk screen, photo silk screen, and use that as the vase. So I had the bottom screened on the way you would do a screen on a ceramic, and then the top was a different kind of drawing. And this is all just the tar scraped away, and you see the tile underneath, like a wood block. You can see the squares. And all that random movement was the sanding machine that we used to sand the tiles, so that when I put the tar on it, it would stick. And when we scraped it away, it left that pattern. And then these are put together so you can see how the flowers kind of burst out of the vase. And the drips and everything is the process of, again, working on the flowers. And they just run down on, or cover the vase like the edges of the paintings peel over the top. It was a sort of a unifying factor. This one I took of a disaster, like the one you have upstairs, the dead plant. But this was a ferry that sunk in the Netherlands. And they were raising it. And I decided, well, now we should make it a tourist pot. So I screened it on this, what's a vase, and I planted some flowers in it, some oranges. So you have this very violent image that's been taken, like many images we have, and just put into something for sale. Kind of a mechanical image. And this was a little roses and a green vase. I made a small one. This is a 4-foot square painting. And I haven't seen this in a long time. When I was going through the slides, I looked at it and I thought, geez, you know, I really should have made more of those. And this one, I'd done a number of black lemons that I'd put into still lives, which probably a lot of people have seen. At the same time, I'd found black eggs at the Chinese grocery store, the 100-year-old eggs, which they'd packed in tea and dirt. So I stuck those into still lives and I took pictures of them. And I used those in a lot of still lives as well. And I decided to go back and start inserting them into a field of different flowers, and sometimes into tomatoes, or just using them as a kind of nestled field of black. So these are eggs and roses. But again, they sort of rhyme again with the dominoes and the black flower images. This one I made singularly, and then I decided I would make another one that I didn't. They start like this, and then when I reworked them, it became like this. But then I thought I would just leave one like that, which I thought was my Matisse ode. And I liked it. I never did another one quite like that except for the pink one and the egg, but it was very successful, I thought. Nobody liked it but me. But that led to the smoke rings. And in 1980s, early 80s, I had been, actually in 79, I'd been at Crown Point Press, and I was made a series of etchings called Water Under the Bridge, which started with a boat, and which was also a table upside down, and broken down into all the different ways of manipulating that, ending with a cigarette and smoke. And so I did a number of cigarette paintings at the time in the 80s, which were 4 feet, and the tiles were it was the human architecture. It was the idea that this was your smokestack, and I sometimes would butt it up against what looked like the edge of a building in a smokestack to be illuminated from it. I did them in different sizes. And then after I did those roses, I thought, you know, I'd like to revisit the smoke ring. So I first did a series of photographs of them, which I showed. And I loved the photographs because I thought it was kind of a new way of looking at photography the way I'd done it. Because here was an image against a black background that was definitely smoke, but it had really no depth of field, but it wasn't totally flat. So I thought I'd try to make some large pictures and go back to being more expressive, because the works I'd been doing were becoming very geometric. So I made these smoke ring paintings, and I found that by using the spackle, it was also the idea of taking something that's so soft and ephemeral and making it very hard. So that sat right into the tar, and I put spackle on there, plaster. I did them with a sponge, and I built them up, and then I kept working over them so that the sepia from the tar would also give it a kind of brown hue. And they became very, very expressive, these pictures. And they're some of my favorites from this time. And it's funny because when I first did it, people didn't even see it as smoke. But they're very... It led into some of the newest work I'm doing, where I'm turning those hard button... that hard button material, that hard paint, into almost looking like a liquid. So I'm turning something hard to look like a liquid, and I'm turning something soft into something very hard. And these are quite large, and but they float. They really they're sculptural and expressive, and it had the whole body working in it. So I really felt like I'd come back into the theater. I mean, the first time somebody saw this, they asked me if there were birds. And then I did birds, but I'm not showing them. And the poppies, from the flowers you saw, I started doing these poppies. And initially, they were kind of based on the poppies that we had from the Veterans Day, from the World War I Field of Flanders. And they're made out of crumpled paper, and they stick in your lapel. And I wanted them to be artificial, but at the same time, because they're not really based on actually copying a poppy. They were more based on those. The French ones have a plastic center that has the pin in it, so it's a hard dot in the center. But I decided to paint these with a kind of leaf, and I did a number of drawings of these as well. And they, you know, as different as they are from the morning glories, they sort of harked back to that. And again, it was a pattern, a pinwheel. I even cut some of these out. I made and I used them as poppies on Veterans Day and made a little paper lapel pin. But then I thought, why not go all the way now and make them totally artificial, make them buttons again? So I decided just to eliminate the imagery of the petal. And I flocked the center so they're fuzzy like the dice. I carved away the backgrounds and I made these like Chinese red lacquer. And I did these in a number of different colors. You'll see a few here. But after I started doing them in colors, I sort of wish that I had only made them all red. And that would have been, and again, it would have been a kind of reaffirmation of the system of doing it over and over again. But I used artificial colors, and I got into like car colors and kind of like the dice like this, like the old aqua of the Fords. And I liked it. I like this too, but would have been sort of interesting to make them all red. These are quite big, and they really, these become field paintings. This is all navy blue flocking embedded in the tar with a kind of a shiny lacquered center. And that came from this one. This was a color chart of all the available flocking colors you could buy. And it's really a kind of a nice. It's all fuzzy. This one I think of as my Miro painting. This is you can see the green linoleum, which they use in every elementary high school, as the background. And then there was a masses of that fuzzy flocking with the lacquered colors in there. There's the pink from the dice. And this is a very highly polished flower picture. And then I thought, well, let's see, let's go back to the landscape again for a little bit. So I took the sets from the Japanese No theater, which are only pine trees, and I decided to oversimplify them. So I made Japanese pines. And as you can see, the carving now becomes horizontal. So it can almost look, if you look at it, it can almost become like the back of a water of a lake with the ripples in it. And then I decided that I would go back to revisit from the vases. I hung lanterns like this on the trees in my garden, and I thought I would take the lanterns out and I would start making some lanterns. And my mother saw an invitation of these for one of my shows, and she says, "Oh man, I love those pumpkins." So then I took the flower out of the vase, And I started making a pattern with those. And this is a large black and white Japanese pine. And then I hung the lanterns on it. So that's the latest painting. So then I thought, now what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go kind of fast, and we're going to go through some drawings. So I hope you're not too tired. I'm not going to do too much talking, but I kind of wanted to show... these are early drawings, charcoal drawings of tulips, that so you can see how the imagery continues through from the 80s to the 2008. The charcoal that I used at this time, I used for the lemons as well. And it was an idea of compression and soot and powder and grit making something that took on a life of its own. And the story that I had about these was I went to it when I first moved to New York. I was a young artist, and I had a show at Willard, and I was meeting all these fancy people. And a woman invited me to dinner, and she had this most beautiful round table for a dinner party. In the center was a circle of red tulips that were all perfectly straight in a line like that. And I thought, wow, I've never seen anything like that. That is really beautiful. So I went home, and I bought tulips, and I thought, I'm going to paint them like that. So I put them in a vase, and of course, that's what they did. And I thought, now that's weird. I asked her, you know, where'd you get the flowers that were straight like that? They were so perfect. She said, I put wire in the stem. I thought, wow, she put wire in the stem. But I sort of like these better. And so I did a whole thing of this, and I'm going to kind of go through these kind of quickly because they're sort of a little bit like watching a symphony. They take on this kind of physical, almost a human figure, but they're just the sort of sooty, gritty tulip image. And I did a lot of work with these. I made a few paintings of these, and... I did etchings of them. I did mostly drawings, though. And the black lemons came directly out of this. I eliminated the leaves and the stems and just used the bulb and closed it at the end. And that's where the lemons came from. I think of that as Greta Garbo. And then I started thinking, I made a series of these, which I'm going to go through sort of one after the other with just a rhythm, so you could just enjoy looking at them. I took one brush and eight, a little box of Rich Art children's tempera paint, and I thought, how many images can I make from just those colors and that one brush, and how can I do that? And I'm still doing it. I must have made 150 or 200 of them. But since then, they've quit making Rich children's art tempera, and I can't get it anymore, which is very peculiar. So I've gone through an entire industry. That's it. So I thought we'll end on the simple note. So. So if there's any questions, I would be happy to evade them.
Yes. What size are the work on?
Those little, they're 8.5 by 11 inches. And actually, the paper that I use for all of those is also now, you can't buy that anymore. So that's a two industry, as I've got. And the charcoal I use for the tulips and the lemons, you can't buy anymore either. That's gone out of business. And the fixative as well. It's getting tough. Yeah. No, it's not on canvas. The one I did some canvas ones. The one that the museum owns here is canvas. I did, I think, maybe 5 large canvases with the same materials.
So it's 12 by 12?
No, they're quite big. They're 8 by 8. I've done 12 by 12s, too. The little ones are also the same. I use plaster, so as you have the like a fresco embedded in the tar, which is embedded in the linoleum. So it's kind of like a cutout. It's the floor and the wall and paintings, and it's all the different things together. The idea that really came from Art de Povera when I was, you know, a student, was trying to take the architecture of the buildings and the materials of buildings and make something else out of it. So they were very cheap and readily available materials, which over the years became less available. But in fact, when I first started spreading the tar, I used to think that's where Jimmy Hoffa was. Well, you can heat it up, but usually I cut it in tubes, and we just use a caulking gun to put it down and spread it with trowels.
So it doesn't smell as bad as a heated tar?
Well, real tar like that doesn't dry, and so it's always liquid. And that's the problem they have with 17th century, say 1700 paintings like the Raft of the Medusa and these things, which they use bitumen for the blacks, and every now and then they have to take it back because it's slipping down. Tar is an old material for painting. It goes back to the beginning, and also the word sepia is the seepage from the tar. So that's where that color comes from, too. And plaster, of course. I use spackle because it's more durable, but plaster is that's all the Greeks use. Besides, apparently they invented wax in caustic painting, but we don't have any examples of it. No.
No.
Not by now. The accidents are happy accidents.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
In your abstract forms, in terms of your thinking, do they ever have any personal reference in your thinking, or do they come out of that in any way, or is it just purely abstract?
Well, some of them have nothing to do with things that I do. Like, I didn't have dominoes, and I didn't really play cards when I did card playing drawings and things like that. But most of the things come from the things that are in the studio or things that are in my life around me. I take it out of there. And when I was in Saint-Tropez and I was doing all these paintings, people said, were you influenced by being in Saint-Tropez? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, they have all that beautiful light, and it really, the first thing I thought of was black tar. So basically, you take your ideas with you, and it doesn't matter where you are. But I did use images from the garden that I had there. And the acanthus, I don't know why I stuck that in there. It kind of broke up the theory, the flow. But it's an interesting painting, because I'd never seen an acanthus plant before. And as I was doing it, I realized that that's the oldest architectural image. That's the image that you see on all the carved mantles of marble fireplaces, and all of our old money used to be decorated with the acanthus leaves. It's a classical image. And so it sort of fit somehow with, I don't know why they picked that plant, but they did. Yeah.
To follow that question about abstraction, I read somewhere that you feel like even though your work is of a still life genre, but you see it all first and foremost as abstraction.
Yeah.
Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. I don't try really to render the things I'm doing necessarily in a sort of a realistic way. I try to represent it in a straightforward way, so that basically what you see when you see even the still life that's rendered or the roses or whatever, those are really about gesture and how the paint makes something that looks like a rose. It doesn't really resemble a rose. It's not trying to be that. It's its own image. These are photo screens, and I just drew the vases, but I picked those because those flowers don't have any basis, really, in reality. They're just a quick Chinese painter at the factory is knocking off these images. And that's made up completely. I have no idea what that is. Those are the brush marks. All the flowers really resemble a flower, only in that the brush, when you move it, makes petals, what looks like transparencies through it in piles. So they're called wallflowers because they could be wallpaper, they could be anything, but they're meant to be flowers that are hung on the wall. They're not representations of anything in particular. The still lives, again, I used artificial light. I made it look volumetric because the idea in the still lives was to include in modern art, to start putting volume and weight back into painting, so that it was, instead of just the furniture part of the art, the visual would have a weight as well. And then with the smoke, you still have a weight. And these are very sculptural in a way. But the new ones, they're almost becoming weightless in the imagery, but the structure is hard. And one of the things that lends the paradox is what makes the art go, really, is the thing between the sturdiness of the structure, the seeming architectural quality of it, and the ephemeral quality of the meaning that you see when you see the front, very thin part of the art. And that's why I went to the dark landscapes, because these are almost cities that have been built, these industrial cities, which are dead. And they were called plants, because it has that natural cycle. And I used a lot of things that you would think wouldn't happen but could, and then would introduce into it the human response system for dealing with chaos. So you would have firemen at the fire, and you would have people, the trucks, coming to fix a blown up building or a melted rig of an oil burnout or something like that. So there's always the difference between something that's dissolving and then trying to deal with that. And the still lives too. I mean, they don't last. Flowers don't last. The cut flowers don't last, and so on.
So you created those images. I guess I always like using some photographic reference.
For which? No, they came from newspapers, from the newspaper stories of an abandoned plant or a bombing somewhere or a fire somewhere. Yeah, just a news clip. Yeah. The funny thing is after doing those for many years, suddenly after 9/11, the fireman became the symbol of American goodness. And it's funny, I mean, I'd already done 20 years of fireman. Nobody seemed to think that. But it's interesting how it catches up. In fact, right after 9/11, I was at Michigan. I was doing a show of the smoke rings. And this poet, who's a really wonderful poet named Max Blagg, had written a poem to the smoke rings. And it's all about this kind of going up in smoke, right? So I was reading it, and really everybody in the place started crying. It was so amazing. And it was quite touching, even though it wasn't directly addressing itself to that particular thing. I found the further away I went from New York, the more upset people were.
Yeah.
fact, it was the Michigan game playing Western Michigan. They had the honor guard and everything at the visitors' goalpost. So they wanted to jinx their win. But it was an interesting thing to see. And the smoke, you know, it's kind of, again, it's like the dead plants. It reminds you that things very quickly disappear. Yeah.
Going back to this series that you showed at the end here, I mean, I don't know, maybe it was the rapid fire nature of going through them, but I found that sometimes I got kind of a very kind of pleasurable and simple emotional rush seeing something come up and it's gone and something else takes its place. And it brings up in my mind questions about you. One of them is, how much time goes into one of these 8x11 works, and to what extent do you get any kind of emotional therapy out of doing it?
I get a lot out of it. And the time, it depends on the picture. Like this one, I did very quickly, and then I realized that was it. And some I'll do and let dry, and I'll go back and put another color so it doesn't run. So they have different time sequences, and sometimes I fuss with them, and I think, oh man, I shouldn't do that. But then in the end, at the long run, you know, that looks okay too. So I get quite a charge out of them. And the reason I like to go through them fast, sort of, is that I think it's nice when you come to look at pictures of art to have an experience where somebody's not talking and that you can just look at something. But, you know, if I went through them too slowly, I mean, then you're waiting for it to end. So now you might want to see more of them and you can go to a gallery and take a look. Yeah. No, when I was an undergraduate, I started to pour Roplex into large puddles. I'd take the canvas and I'd make a table and a ridge around the edge with wood, and then I would pour Roplex in it. Sometimes it would be underpainting so that the painting, when it was finished, it would be this clear lacquer over it. But now I see a lot of people are doing that, but the materials are better and they're hard. They're almost like decoupage. You see it a lot in California now. It's like the paintings are sealed with a high gloss. I guess it's the material they use for surfboards. But these had, you know, would dry with ripples and things in them, so I thought it was like looking through water, and somebody said they reminded him of Da Vinci's water studies. But then I thought, well, I want to put imagery into it. So I started cutting wooden images out of wood, and I would take rocks and bottle caps and things, and I'd throw it in there. And then when it hardened, it looked like a polluted thing with debris stuck in it. So I called those debris paintings. And when I went to New York, I took a loft that was a third floor walk up, and I didn't want to lug that barrel of plastic. So I started looking for something else, and I found the linoleum. I mean, that's a whole story. It's been written about a lot. But the black goo was really what they used to spread, put on the floor to put the linoleum down. But it didn't hold up vertically. The tiles would fall off. But it gave me the idea to find a black material, so I started using caulking, which was another thing from the hardware store. I started drawing with it so that the lines were almost not attached to the paper, but they were independent. Instead of being in the paper, they were on the paper. And then I started spreading it, so it was like a reverse of what was under the tile. So that's where it came from. It started about 1978 or 9, 76, 77, something like that. It's all about flipping things over, trying new things. I mean, you saw an awful lot of dots up there, but they were used in different ways. Is that it? Yeah.
Just wanted to know, what made you use the charcoal to do those? Because you've shown us lots of color, and then the tulips and the lemons with the charcoal.
I wanted it to take a natural image and make it out of dirt, you know, basically, out of a soot. And the thing that made those possible, really, was the fixative at the time was a Liquitex fixative. You could fix it so well that you could have big chunks of charcoal stuck to it. But now you can't do that. They don't make fixative like that. And I suppose I could mix it myself, but I don't really want to do that. I'll work with what I can just buy. I mean, you can still fix charcoal, but you can't. It's hard to get it to be that gooey. It was really a great moment, but it's probably killed everybody that worked with it. I haven't heard from them in a long time. Yeah.
Do you have a process for deciding how large to make a painting?
Well, all the paintings are based on, they're all standard. They're all parts of what the tile is in 1 foot increments. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 squares. When I put three together like this, they become horizontal. If I take one away, it's a square, or vertical if it's two. So it's really just a system of 2, 4, 6, 8. And so, I mean, some of the ones, I started doing the really large ones, actually, because nobody was buying big paintings, so I thought I'd make them really big. I see what difference it made. If you weren't going to buy it, I might as well enjoy making big ones.
From the 4x4 to the much larger, if that ever had any bearing on when you were looking at a certain image that you wanted to work with, if you thought in terms of just the physical scope being better suited?
Well, I thought that the smoke rings worked best in an 8-foot format. But then I made a couple of 4-foot ones, and they were very nice too. So I didn't make very many of those, but I thought that the larger format was good because you got the whole body involved in the gesture. When you make a smaller one, you're using a different, you only half. So I kind of like doing the whole, all the body on the big ones, but most of them can work, I think, in any size. In fact, this one I made a print of. It's about this big. And it's really nice. I didn't think it would work smaller, but it does. Is that it? Well, thanks for coming.